loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. The Supreme Court today heard a case called Janus versus AFSCME, the Public Service Union, that observers say will have a very far-reaching impact on labor and the labor movement in the United States. At issue is whether workers who benefit from collective bargaining agreements negotiated by unions have to pay union dues. They have paid because of that benefit almost since the advent of unions in this country. Then we take a look at the fact that there are more than 2,000 people serving sentences of life in prison without parole in American prisons for crimes they committed as children. 20 states and the District of Columbia banned such draconian sentences, and recent Supreme Court rulings could make them illegal altogether. We're talking to one of those who served 30 years in prison after being convicted at the age 15. But first, we turn to a Supreme Court case that will have wide and far-reaching implications for the labor movement. We are joined from Pittsburgh by Peter Knowlton. He is the president of the United Electrical, Radio, and Machine Workers of America. Welcome back, Peter.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Thank you. I mean, this is huge. It's, of course, on the front page of all the mainstream corporate-owned media like the New York Times or the Washington Post. But what we rarely hear is the voice of labor. And so we want to hear your voice to be able to tell the story about why this case is so dangerous for unions and as a consequence for all working people in the United States.
So I think people need to understand this case is not just in and of itself bad, which it is, but it's also in the context of everything that's going on in the country, not just since Donald Trump has been president, but obviously for the last number of decades and the assault, wholesale assault. That corporations and big business and their partners in the federal government have been waging against organized labor. It advanced dramatically and upticked dramatically under Ronald Reagan, which when he busted the air traffic controllers and then proceeded to create the modern day union busting industry. So anything that the Right to Work Committee, which is a very virulent anti-union organization, or the corporations or conservatives have been able to do, they will pick away at the rights that workers have in any way that they can. And this is just another way that they can pick away and try to dilute the power that workers have by expressing themselves, by having a union and then financially supporting it.
And then, you know, one of the things that I think most Americans don't understand is if a worker does not want to join the union is still compelled by law to negotiate on that worker's behalf. The union then gets no benefit from a worker that doesn't want to pay union dues, but the union still has to put itself out there for that employee.
And then the union also has to devote so much of its time to collecting dues from people who get the benefits but may not want to pay it. That also drains resources. So instead of organizing for workplace issues or better benefits or better pay, all the things that unions are designed to do, the unions are compelled to do this rear guard action just to raise basic finances. Go ahead, Peter.
No, it does. It does. I mean, and the whole theory behind, obviously, about the having a union contract with an employer and then having everybody be tithed. Which is really what you're talking about, having tithes every month and put money into the union account, because that's how organizations are able to survive, is by having resources and finances, obviously, one substantial point of that resources. But the real issue is that to a large degree, what Janus will do and what Right to Work legislation has done around the country in 29 states and what federal employees have is that there is a contract. Which between two parties, between the workers and an employer. And within that contract, it lays out that people are going to pay dues to the organization to support their organization, that part of that workers' organization. And very similar to us paying taxes in a community, even though we may not like the particular government that we have in our town, I'm still obligated to pay taxes for schools, for roads, for highways, for some communities, for utilities, and other things that we get from our government for services. So even though you may not agree with a particular issue that your union is taking up, it does not in any way, shape, or form mean that you should not, therefore, support that organization, which everybody will admit lays a floor. And in some ways, it raises the ceiling for many workers on wages, hours, and all sorts of conditions of work, including, obviously, health insurance, which is a big issue for people. But to think somehow that you're expressing or somehow deleting or deflating my freedom by making me pay union dues to an organization that improves my quality of life is kind of bizarre for myself as a trade unionist. And then, as you said before, plus to add insult to injury, not only not now do I not have to pay under Janus, I will not have to pay any kind of union dues or any kind of tie to my organization. But as well, if I get in trouble, the union has to represent me. And for us, that's just such a huge contradiction and clearly just sort of bespeaks for what the real intent of this effort is.
Yeah, that doesn't make any logical sense whatsoever. And I have to agree with you. I think the real intent is to finally break the backs of the unions. God knows that the National Right to Work Committee and so many conservative political figures in this country over the last 75 years or more have been trying to break the backs of the unions across the United States.
Yeah, and right to work means, right, as the unions point out, right to work for less, because wages will go down if the unions are weaker. And you look at the states that have right to work, and the number of states is growing, including traditional strong labor states.
And in the public sector.
But the right to work, Peter, just again, these are euphemistic terms that are really meant to confuse people and throw sand in their eyes. Because the bosses and the business associations that are trying to push this kind of legislation through, they talk about workers must have the right of free speech. You shouldn't be compelled to join a union you don't want to join, or to have that union do any lobbying or support for any political candidate if it's not your candidate. So it's a free speech issue. But of course, these are euphemisms, and right to work isn't about the right to work, because none of these states have the right to a job, a right to an employment when you're, you know, when you get out of school. It's really about to work under particular conditions. Go ahead.
Well, not only that, I mean, people should, I think, you know, if people don't know, they can do a search on the internet themselves, just do the history of right to work or the origins of right to work. And you'll see who the people are that originally began this concept of so-called right to work, which is why we call it right to work for less, because it is, on average, people make much less pay, less benefits, much worse working conditions in right-to-work states than they do in non-right-to-work states. But in the origins of right-to-work, it was basically started by people who were members of the Klan, who were business people, who were virulent, racist, xenophobes, who decided that one of the best ways to heighten their own racism and to heighten the power of the Klan was also by taking on the labor movements, because one of the things that the labor movement probably does better than most other organizations of any type is it brings people together, unites working class people regardless of their race, their gender, or their sexual outlook. It unites everybody based on class. So whatever the bosses and whatever the employers can do to try to divide those forces within us, they will try to do that. That is what right to work is all about. It is an attempt to divide workers against each other, try not to see what their common interests are, and to try to get us to pit one another, because when we're fighting one another, right, we're not fighting the employer, we're not fighting capital. We're not taking on those issues that we really need to take on together in a unified kind of way. But people really need to understand the underpinnings of where this movement originated from and where it came from. And it was some of the most nefarious forces in our country, in the business community, in the early 1900s, and in the South. Predominantly is where it began, was in the South, and obviously it's expanded to other places around the country since then. But this is, you know, the one thing that, there's one thing that people also need to understand, which is if Janus is passed, it's not going to destroy the labor movement. It's going to be a huge setback. It's going to make it much more difficult for people. It's going to make it much more difficult for our union. We represent a lot of public sector workers that are in non-right-to-work states, especially in New England. This is definitely going to have an impact on us. But it won't destroy the labor movement. As long as workers are around, and as long as there is a, and as long as there's workers and there's employers, there will always be some form of a labor movement. There will always be workers in motion, workers in struggling, taking on the employer. So I think it's a little bit, myself personally, I think it's a little overinflated to say it's going to destroy the labor movement, because I think as long as workers are around, there will always be ways to organize and come together to take on the employer to improve their lives and the lives of their families. But I don't think it's a stretch at all to say that this is an attempt by employers to severely weaken us in ways we have not seen in quite a while. And they're absolutely going at this, and they're trying to make that somehow paying dues is a free speech issue is bizarre to us. I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous, but that's how they've been able to frame the debate for people to be able to think that's what we're talking about. We don't have the First Amendment to the Constitution. When you walk through the door right now in our country, you lose that right when you walk through the door.
We're speaking with Peter Knowlton. He's in Pittsburgh. He's the president of the United Electrical, Radio, and Machine Workers of America. I wanted to raise something that I'm seeing at WTAE.com. WTAE is a local news channel or local channel in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. It says here, the unions say the outcome could affect more than 5 million government workers. 5 million government workers in 24 states and the District of Columbia. Do you think those numbers are accurate?
Oh, yeah, no, I think there's other, because don't forget, you're talking about all public sector workers, all state workers, all municipal workers, all school workers, all county workers. So it's anybody who gets a paycheck from a public employer is going to be affected by this in one way, shape, or form. And out of those 26 states, I think there's absolutely that many people. I actually think that's probably a little bit low. I think it's probably quite a bit higher than that. But you're definitely talking about it's going to impact millions and millions of union members.
I wanted to also raise the issue of what exactly this Janus person is objecting to. He said that he did not want to pay union dues, not because the union was then endorsing a certain political candidate or slate of candidates or even donating money to those candidates, but just because the general lobbying activities of the union were objectionable to him. So what are the general lobbying what's the general lobbying of the union? It is going to Washington or to the state capitals and lobbying for workers' rights, safer workplaces, better health care, better working conditions and more pay. And that's what he was objecting to.
Yeah, which is obviously nonsensical. This guy,
sure, he's a straw man.
He's a straw man. He's a front man for business interests. In the name, because you know your boss loves free speech. They want you to always,
right.
as Peter was making the point, when we walk through the door in a factory or in a workplace, you don't have free speech rights. You can't just say whatever you want. They don't. Matter of fact, you'll be disciplined or fired
That's
if you
right.
do. But and the union gives you some protection for your free speech, right? So that you can't be, you know, punished or fined or docked or fired because you've said something that the boss doesn't like. You have a contract. You have a collective bargaining agreement that gives you a guarantee of employment, regardless of what your political views are. That the unions actually are the guarantors for free speech, right? So all of these words are euphemism. It's kind of Alice in Wonderland, using the words to turn reality upside down. Peter, I want to go back to a point that you made, which I think is a critically important point. Labor has suffered numerous setbacks over multiple decades now. You mentioned the PATCO, the mass firing of air traffic controllers by Ronald Reagan. That strike was ultimately defeated. That was a shock, and that was with millions of workers who came out on Solidarity Day in 1981, who protested, who participated. And yet they were fired and the government got away with it. And then there was just a series of attacks on labor in all kinds of ways. At the same time, there was deindustrialization, jobs left the country, the hollowing out of big parts of the industrial parts of America where the unions were strongest. And now it seems like the business community is targeting public sector unions because those are the parts of the labor movement that are still strong. A big part of the public sector workers are in unions, unlike private sector. I'm wondering if the labor movement, sensing the imminent and grave danger posed by these repeated assaults, is there something new that labor can do to turn the tide? Since it seems like for the past three decades, it's been one blow after another. Not all, but many, many blows. Go ahead.
Well, I think first is that the labor movement has to, in our own estimation, in my own, you know, I'm just not speaking for myself. This is kind of how we feel ourselves within the UE, which is the acronym on what we call ourselves, United Electrical Radio Machine Workers. So those of us in the UE, the leaders, I mean, our basic critique is that labor has essentially fallen down. I mean, it's still sitting down on its butt and it's not willing to stand up and fight for those causes that are really clear for us, and that we really need to get together and we got to do a better job at standing up for not only our members, but also for workers. And we have to be more militant during contract negotiations. We have to take a stronger, more progressive stand on some of the key issues of the day. So, for instance, around single-payer health care in particular is an issue that continues to have some forces within labor that aren't supporting it, which is bizarre to us. Completely bizarre. So, and be able to take a little bit more militant action so that, for instance, after Ronald Reagan busted PACCOR during that whole battle, our union was calling for the rest of the labor movement, as well as some other unions, were calling for some expression, some national expression of disgust and anger at what it was that Ronald Reagan and his administration was trying to do to PACCO. Whether that would be a general strike of 15 minutes, a half an hour, a half a day, whatever it would be, that there needed to be some sort of collective national expression of disgust. The AFL-CIO did not do that. Lane Kirkland was the president of the AFL-CIO at the time. I was in the central body in Minneapolis, Minnesota. We actually passed resolutions all over the country. Central labor councils were passing resolutions, as were local bodies, calling for Kirkland to do something. They refused. And the result of it was a big demonstration in D.C. for 500,000 to 1,000,000 people to show up. But you're not going to change the dynamics, and you're not going to win those kind of battles that we have to win just by holding demonstrations. It clearly just does not put enough pressure on the employers, on the politicians that need that pressure applied to, or on capital in order for them to get and to change their equation. We have to be a little bit more militant. We have to be a little bit more creative. We have to think outside the box. We have to do things that we would normally not think of doing in order to put the pressure necessary in order to get the politicians and the corporate employers to do something different. This comes up in a regular basis. We know in our own union that the best way for us to settle a very successful agreement is not just the BS that we throw out on our side of the table. That works good. Making good, solid arguments, having the data in order to support your arguments is good, but you really need the organizational support of the membership. And if you don't have that strong organizational support of the membership willing to push the employer hard, you're not going to be able to get the results that you need in that collective bargaining agreement. The same applies nationally into our community. If we're not able to mobilize ourselves and be able to mobilize workers in such a way that really puts pressure hard on the employers and on the politicians, you're not going to be able to change the equation. And we just can't do it through a supporting Democrat establishment candidates as well. And I think the labor movement has to be four square behind a candidate like Bernie Sanders. You can't have any. When you have the visions of the labor movement or that kind of a candidate, you know you're in trouble.
Just think back, John, to 2009, Obama won. You know, labor played a major role. Mm-hmm. I mean, labor in Pennsylvania, where Peters is. I mean, labor was all over Pennsylvania, convincing especially workers in white communities to vote for Barack Obama. That was a historic vote.
And sure was.
And in many ways, the labor movement turned the tide. And Obama had promised, and he had the House behind him. He had the Senate behind him. He was popular. He promised that there would be card check. In other words, that instead of having to go through the whole NLRB election rigmarole, which is just a way of defeating union organizing drives, that you could have a card check. You could circulate cards on your workplace. If the majority of people sign the card, then you could, you know, you could start a union and you could enter into collective bargaining.
Yes.
But Obama, once in office, and this is what happens over and over again, it's not Obama the person, but the Democrats, they want labor support. They take labor's donations and all the street work that labor does, going door to door, and then they don't deliver because they feel maybe labor is going to be taken for granted because the Republicans are so bad that they're the lesser evil. Peter, when we look back at American history and labor history, we have some things that can be learned, which doesn't mean that they're easy to replicate. But you take the 1930s, where workers actually won the right to unionize. The Wagner Act was passed. That was at the time of the sit-down strikes. Probably 1,000 factories had been seized by workers who couldn't really go out on strike because there were so many unemployed, but they sat down and seized factories. There was the general strikes in 1934 in Toledo and Minneapolis and San Francisco. During that whole period of really militant action, the CIO, at least, was also crusading for black freedom and black equality. It was like the vanguard of the civil rights movement in many ways in the mm-hmm. 30s. I mean, isn't that where we have to end up if we're going to stop this slide, you know, this slide to the bottom? Well, I think we're having a technical problem, John, with Peter Knowlton's line. He's in contract negotiations right now in Pittsburgh, so probably been on the phone a lot. We're going to also be joined in studio now by Walter Smolarek, Sputnik News analyst, and also the producer of this show, Loud and Clear. Walter, you're from Pittsburgh.
True, true.
And John Kiriakou, you're from Pittsburgh.
I am indeed.
And Peter Knowlton was from Pittsburgh. And of course, Pittsburgh, Walter, was in many ways the center or one of the main centers of the U.S. labor movement. And it's no accident that Peter Knowlton, president of the UE, United Electrical Workers, is talking to us from Pittsburgh. But Pittsburgh, like many other cities, has shifted. It used to be big steel. Mm-hmm. Now, most of those industries around which or in which the labor movement grew strong in the 1930s, in the 40s, in the 50s, much of that industry has been sent overseas or been replaced, real jobs replaced by robots.
Not one ounce of steel has been produced inside the Pittsburgh city limits since 1979.
Yeah.
And now Pittsburgh is really in the avant-garde of technology, banking, and medical services. It's an example, really, for the rest of the country.
And these are some of the structural problems. We're talking about the Janus case, where public service workers' unions may not be able to collect dues from their members. And the public service workers are, as we mentioned earlier, a big part of the unionized labor force in America. But here, and so it's going directly at them. The bosses and the trade associations are going at those unions, the public sector workers union. But what I was asking, Walter, what I was asking Peter was, can labor come back and by what methods? And I was making the point that there were the militant sit-down strikes in the 1930s. There were the general strikes in Toledo, San Francisco, Minneapolis. But also the CIO, the Congress of Industrial Organizations, was in many ways, because it was a left organization, right in the vanguard of the movement for black equality, for civil rights, especially in the South. It was this combination of on the site workplace militancy and helping to build a broader social movement for justice that gave the unions a premier standing in this country. It seems to me that the public sector workers' unions especially could play that role once again, given the composition of public sector workers, the fact that so many are in urban areas, and the fact that they can't send their jobs overseas because they're public service workers. Maybe that's why these bosses' organizations are targeting public sector workers. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think that has a lot to do with it. I think that the austerity regime that's been in place in the United States for many, many years, but especially since the 2008 financial crisis, that's also a significant part of why public sector unions are under attack so much, because public sector workers are organized. They have the ability to fend off attacks in many cases on their living standards. And so, you know, when the politicians look like, where are we going to cut from the budget? They're certainly not going to cut from, you know, things like the military. They're probably not going to raise taxes on corporations if they can help it. They could, you know, gut the pensions of public sector workers. They could, you know, lay off the workers who have more seniority and therefore have earned a higher salary. So I think that's one of the many reasons why the public sector unions are under attack. You know, we have seen, going back to your other point about how unions can be in the leadership of movements, we've seen the Fight for 15 in the last several years galvanize a whole lot of energy. I mean, I've been to many of the demonstrations, and the energy, the enthusiasm, the participation from workers and from progressive people, you know, the broad-based working class unity that's on display there, that has won on the local and state level substantial gains that are to the benefit of all workers, including workers who are not yet organized into unions.
You know, John, there's also, because the bosses are using, the big bosses and their trade associations are using this euphemistic, confusing language, right to work or free speech. We have a Rasmussen report found that 74% of likely U.S. voters supported right-to-work laws. But what that survey also shows is that most of these people, including most of those who say they support right-to-work, also don't think a non-union worker should enjoy benefits negotiated by the union. But that's the issue.
That is the issue. That's the foundation of the issue.
The union is contractually obligated to support and defend and fight for and grieve about and represent, no matter what, all the members of the bargaining unit, whether they're in or not in the union. So you get the benefits of the union, but you don't want to pay the dues. And most people think that's wrong, but that's what right to work means.
Yeah.
That's what right to work means.
And, you know, the other misleading part, which we were talking with Peter Knowlton from the United Electrical Workers was saying, is that the right to work, you know, it's so unbelievably misleading. Like, if a pollster calls you and says, hey, do you support the right to work? I mean, even if they define it, it's still going to be something that needs clarification. I mean, it sounds like they're talking about the right to have a job, which, of course, is something that the labor movement has been fighting for many, many, many decades and other progressive forces in society. So, you know, if we want to move towards an actual right to work, you know, meaning the right to a job, the right to employment, and the right to a decent income that comes along with that, I mean, that means organizing into unions.
You know, the same bosses' associations would oppose that right to work, the actual right to work, the right to a job. Because guess what? If everybody had the right to a job, to employment, that means there would be a structural alteration in the workforce, and there would be a very small part of the population that would be unemployed. And if there's not that many people who are unemployed, then you can't threaten workers with firing them if they demand higher wages by simply bringing in unemployed people to take their jobs. In other words, that's a leverage that the bosses, the corporations, lose. And so, again, we have the right-to-work agencies like these trade organizations who are actually against the right-to-work. It's just they don't want us to have the right to have effective unions.
It's crazy. You know, when I first moved to Washington to go to school back in 1982, I got a job at a local grocery store chain. I had worked in the grocery store when I was in high school, and I was a member of the United Food and Commercial Workers Union. Well, I got here and was assigned or scheduled for an 8-hour day. I worked 5 hours, and finally I said to one of my colleagues, so when do we get a break? And he said, a break? We don't get a break. There's no union here. You must be from the North. And really, that was my first exposure. It was a very, very small one, but it was my first exposure to a right-to-work state. This is so much more than just taking a 15-minute break or being able to use the bathroom. As you pointed out, Brian, the unions were at the forefront of the civil rights struggle in this country. When I was working for the United Food and Commercial Workers International headquarters here in Washington, they were at the forefront in the fight against sexual harassment in the workplace. So it's not just, you know, collective bargaining and political power, which the unions really don't have much of anymore. It's something to benefit every American, whether
it's about justice,
union member or not.
It's about justice.
That's
about
right.
Justice in the workplace and in our communities. We were joined from Pittsburgh by Peter Knowlton. He's the president of the United Electrical, Radio, and Machine Workers of America. Also in studio, Walter Smolarek, a Sputnik News analyst. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a brief break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
There are more than 2,000 people serving sentences of life without parole in American prisons for crimes they committed as children. 20 states and the District of Columbia have banned such draconian sentences. Another 5 states don't make use of them, and recent Supreme Court rulings could make them illegal altogether. We're joined from Philadelphia by Kempis Songster. He was sentenced to life without parole as a 15-year-old, and he was just released from prison 2 months ago after serving 40 years. Now he's an advocate for ending juvenile life without parole. And we're also joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst Nicole Roussel. Welcome to both of you.
Hey, how's everybody?
Kempis, tell us what your life is like now. You were in prison for such a long time. Do you feel as though the world had passed you by? How are things going?
That was 30 years, too, of incarceration. Let me tell you that the world that I came out into is nothing like the world that I left. You know, you could imagine that in 1987, when I was arrested, there wasn't any such thing as cell phones and the internet, you know, and there were still phone booths on the corners. You know, if you saw somebody with a car phone the size of a shoe, then, you know, they were boss status, you know, but now you see almost everybody's is plugged in. There's this new way of communicating, new way of just managing all your affairs, and it's just so fast paced, you know. And it's been a whirlwind to try in adjusting, you know. And so I thought that I would be able to come out and just, you know, pace myself and take my time and breathe my own air and go for quiet walks and just, you know, try to find the rhythm of the free world again and just tap into the pulse of society and, you know, just allow myself to get my bearings. But I've hit the ground running, and not of my own doing, but it just seems like I've been drawn into this frantic pace, you know, of activity, you know, speaking engagements, just public education, talking to college students about law. And I mean, it's all a blessing because it's all a part of my personal conviction anyway. But I didn't know that it was going to happen so soon and at this pace. And I guess I'm just giving myself to it, you know, and trying to find spaces and time to, you know, give to family, give to myself for self-care, and so that I don't burn out. You know what I mean? But where I can, you know, I'm just managing the tension between, you know, wanting to serve and wanting to give back, and then doing it the right way so that I'm not let into things that I'm not really quite ready to be let into yet.
We're speaking with Kempis Songster from Philadelphia. He was sentenced to life without parole as a 15-year-old, and he was just released from prison 2 months ago after serving 30 years. Nicole, tell us a little bit about some of these court cases. And I'm going to preface this by saying that my best friend's sister was killed by her 11-year-old stepson. And it took years before the courts, it ended up being the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania, finally decided to try him as a juvenile. But he was arraigned in regular court as an adult. And for the first 3 or 4 years, it looked as though he was headed to a life without parole sentence. Talk about some of these cases that the Supreme Court has been seeing.
So there's actually been a number of Supreme Court cases that have addressed this pretty recently, and they've kind of been narrowing the allowance of these sentences down and down and down. So there's really just a narrow kind of sliver of people who are actually able to get this sentence now moving forward. But there are still many, many people who are sitting in prison who were sentenced as children. So in 2005, which was just 13 years ago now, was the first time that the Supreme Court said that you can't give the death penalty to a child.
That's amazing. I had no idea.
Yeah, only recently. That's right.
So before that, children were executed, you know, whenever a jury decided that that was the right thing to do. So that was 2005. In 2010, the Supreme Court said, well, if you weren't convicted of something that was a homicide— so if you were convicted of anything else, of a burglary, assault, rape, anything like that, you cannot get life without parole as a kid.
You know, and that's one of the dirty little secrets of the national incarceration system. And that is that there are thousands of people serving sentences of life without parole for, in many cases, nonviolent offenses, usually drug offenses. Life without parole for a nonviolent offense.
Or for, you know, various kind of property offenses, burglary, you know, theft, those sorts of things too. Absolutely. And in some, this is kind of off topic, but in some states, if you have a couple of felonies behind you, even if they're minor felonies, you can get really quickly amped up to that life without or life with parole sentence for something really nonviolent or minor, like you said.
The three strikes you're out laws that were so popular 2 decades ago or in the last decade. There's a famous case from California where a man had several felonies from decades earlier and then stole a slice of pizza and got life without parole.
They were threatening that in Louisiana with someone who stole a candy bar. They were threatening him with life without. In any case, you're absolutely right. So that was the 2010 Graham and Sullivan versus Florida case. And then in 2012, there was Miller versus Alabama, which goes a little bit further. And it says if a state has a mandatory juvenile life without parole sentence that a judge has no option but to give that sentence, those are now illegal. But it didn't specifically say this applies to everyone who's currently serving in prison. It just said, you know, period, point blank, if a judge had to give the sentence out, it's no longer legal. You can't do that anymore.
Kempis, let's go back to you. 2,500 children, that's the number we're looking at approximately. 2,500 children have been sentenced to juvenile life without parole in the United States. There's a global consensus that children should not and cannot be held to the same standards of responsibility as adults and recognition that children are entitled to special protection and treatment. Talk about that and talk about you. I mean, talk about here you were a child. You were 15 years old. What was it like? What did it feel like to be sentenced to life in prison without parole?
You know, to the original premise that you opened up with about the global consensus, you know, the Convention on the Rights of a Child, which is probably the world's most universally ratified treaty on human rights, said that actually forbade, you know, prohibited the sentencing of children to death and to life without parole. You know, we're talking about almost every country in the world that signed on to that, and the U.S. was a signatory on that treaty as well. But yet still, no other country in the world but the U.S. has children serving life without parole. In fact, the sentence of life without parole, period, for children or adults is not really implemented as it is in the U.S. anywhere else in the world. You know, and so I just think that's very telling for just the most advanced society in the world, you know, on a civilization perspective. But you know how Fyodor Dostoevsky said that the degree of civilization in a society can be measured by entering its prisons. And so when you enter prisons and you see, you know, someone like Joseph Legion, who, if the term one of a kind applies to anybody, it applies to him in the context of how long he's been in prison. No one on planet Earth has been in prison as long as Joseph Legion, who's been in prison since 1953, since the age of 15. Not only is he the oldest juvenile lifer in the country and in the world, but he's the oldest or longest serving prisoner in the world. The longest, no one has been incarcerated as long as him. 1953, to put it in context, at the time when he was put in prison, the FCC had just authorized the use of color TV in public, and he's still in prison. You know, the Vietnam War didn't even start yet. You know, the Beatles didn't even, he was in prison before the Beatles came out, before Michael Jackson came out, before we put a man on the moon, before we even heard of a Martin Luther King. You know, he was already in prison, and he's still in prison. And so, you know, I think that right there, to enter prison and to see someone like him, gray-haired, you know, since the age of 15, just him alone, not to mention all the others, you know, all the other hundreds, you know, and by the way, Pennsylvania, not only does the U.S. have the most juvenile lifers anywhere, but Pennsylvania, the state that I'm in, has the most out of any state, over 500. And Philadelphia, the county that I'm in, has over 300, which is the most of any district, any county. You know, so I just think that that's just is very, very, very telling, and it bears, you know, a closer look at, you know, what kind of society are we, you know, what kind of justice system are we trying to identify with? What kind of society are we trying to leave behind for children? You know, when we have a system that where the difference between the child of an adult than from an adult is just something that, you know, we don't consider or we don't care about. You know, and for me, you know, not to make any justification for what I did, because I take full ownership for what I did, and I'm very responsible for what I did, and I can never live it down. And then probably that's what drives my frantic pace, because I know I have a lot to atone for. I know I cannot replace what I've taken away. I can never bring to the table more than I've taken from it. You know, so that's not what I'm trying to do here. What I'm trying to do is make sure that other children who are at risk of making horrible decisions that have horrific outcomes, you know, that those children, that we take their vulnerabilities into account, and we somehow try to prevent that by not judging them, but by understanding more the vulnerabilities of childhood, the things that the neuroscientists educate us about very well, right? The things that we've been aware about children for thousands of years, in fact, all the way back to when Aristotle talked about the characteristics of adolescence, you know, about children being impulsive and things like that. You know, what do we do as a society to prevent children, to steer them away from these rash acts, like we see what happened in Florida just recently, and we see what all these mass shootings in schools. You know, how do we get in front of it instead of condemning it at the rear end after innocent people are murdered? How do we understand the nature of childhood more and get in front of it and begin the hard work of creating a society that looks at how and why we're creating all these violent tendencies and impulses in our youth? I think that's the more useful questions, the more useful approach to this issue. Beginning with the question of why is this happening? Second question is, what are we to learn from this? And the third question is, how are our real-time actions contributing to making things better as opposed to making things worse?
We're joined from Philadelphia by Kempis Songster. We're very fortunate to be speaking with Kempis Songster. He was sentenced to life without parole as a 15-year-old boy, and he was just released from prison 2 months ago after serving 30 years. Kempis, let's talk about exactly what you just raised, and that is the fact that children's brains aren't even developed when they're in their teen years. They're not even fully developed until they're in their 20s. And I'm looking at a 2012 report from the Sentencing Project. And the Sentencing Project has a list of attributes of people who have been sentenced to life without parole as juveniles. 79% of them witnessed violence in their homes regularly. 32% grew up in public housing. 40% had been enrolled in special ed classes. Fewer than half were attending school at all at the time of their offense. 47% were physically abused. 80% of girls reported physical abuse, and 77% of girls reported histories of sexual abuse. So these are children who have been damaged in the home. They've been damaged in society. They commit an impulsive act and then are treated as adults. Now, you mentioned Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania is one of the worst offenders, maybe the worst offender in this country when it comes to incarcerating juveniles. Michigan and Louisiana aren't much better. And it's something like 20 states that freely incarcerate juveniles and charge them as adults and then incarcerate them as adults. So let's talk about some of the people that you were incarcerated with. Would you call these statistics accurate? Did the people that you were incarcerated with who had committed crimes as children and were charged as adults, did they have any chance in the first place at a real life?
A lot of them, no. You know, and I'm not saying that about myself, because, you know, I had a loving mother. You know, when I ran away from home, you know, my personal story is, you know, I was born in Trinidad and Tobago. You know, my mother came to America when she was 18. She had me when she was 16. She left me in Trinidad. I was age of two with a warm and loving extended family, grandparents and aunts to raise me. And they instilled the best family values into me. And she came to America across seas at a very young age to make what she had hoped would be a life of increased opportunity and possibilities for herself and for me to come to. At the age of seven in 1979, she sent for me. For the next 8 years, I excelled in school in the 95th percentile. You know, I went to junior high school for gifted and talented students. You know, and but she was a single mother from another country, foreign national, trying to raise, you know, a young boy in the inner cities. She did her best. And in 1987, you know, she didn't know, some things started brewing in my mind, different experiences in the inner cities, dealing with bullies and all kind of different things that I speak at length about in other places. You know, I started thinking about running away. And then I met up with a childhood friend who I knew from the second grade. He was also having a bout with depression, and we started commiserating with each other and started plotting and scheming on how we would extricate ourselves from you know, our dull lives. You know, it wasn't bad lives. We had loving parents, but we were looking for adventure. You know, and we were the blind leading the blind. We poisoned each other. That's what we did. We poisoned each other. And he would say the same thing, and he's incarcerated too at the age, since the age of 15. He's currently at Dallas, SCI Dallas, which is another prison in Pennsylvania. And while I was granted parole and released, he received a 5-year hit, you know, which means that he won't see the parole board again until 2022.
When you were first arrested, if you even have clear memories of that event, I mean, so many years ago, what was the process by which your attorneys tried to have you charged as a juvenile? Do you remember how that played out, and why it was that the state insisted on charging you as an adult?
In Pennsylvania, once you are charged with a homicide, you are automatically certified as an adult.
Uh-huh. Regardless of your age.
Regardless of your age, you are automatically certified as an adult. Whereas in many other places, and according to federal law, you're supposed to have a certification hearing first, where you go to a hearing. This is the process. You go to a hearing, and then arguments are made on both sides by the DA and your defense as to whether or not you should be transferred to adult court. But that didn't happen. In Pennsylvania, you are automatically certified as an adult and placed in the adult system. And then what I had was a decertification hearing in reverse, which was a hearing to determine whether I should be transferred out of the adult system back to the juvenile system.
And when you say the system, you weren't just talking about going to juvenile court versus regular court. You were also being held in an adult facility, correct?
Yeah, I was. Yeah, in an adult facility. I was placed in Adult County Prison Detention Center, and I was held there pre-trial. And when I was denied, months later, when I had my decertification hearing, I was denied being sent back to juvenile courts, and I was kept in the adult courts and tried as an adult and convicted. Also, I was offered a plea agreement, too. I have to let you know that I was offered a plea agreement for 10 to 20, for third degree, which carried 10 to 20 years at the time. And I turned the deal down. You know, I turned the deal down. My co-defendant, Damien, turned the deal down. And this is something that my lawyer pointed out many years later as one of the hallmarks of, you know, the immature, you know, impulsive, not appreciating the gravity of the situation at hand kind of characteristics that you see, you know, guiding young people.
Nicole, that has to be a pattern all across America too. If you're 15 years old, as we said a few minutes ago, your brain's not fully developed. You tend to be impulsive. I mean, that's in part why you find yourself in this position in the first place. So how is a juvenile going to make a decision? A life or death decision is really what it comes down to when he can't even make a decision as to, you know, what to wear some days.
Absolutely. And what Kempis is talking about, it absolutely happens other places and with other people, but it also happens in other parts of this. There's just so many reasons that kids shouldn't be tried in adult courts and be held at adult facilities. Another one happens when kids are being interrogated, just the kid and, like, you know, the interrogator. And kids, their brains aren't ready for this, right? So they think, you know, I'm just going to say whatever it is that they want me to say. I want to go home and, like, get some snacks. I'm hungry, right? Or, like, I want to go home because I, you know, need to pick up my sister. It's hard to think through long-term consequences. We know that brains don't actually develop. Like, that's the last part of your brain to develop. As you mature, right, you start to be able to actually weigh long-term consequences. That hasn't even happened yet. So people, kids will, you know, admit guilt. Yes. We know this happens constantly.
We saw that in the case in Wisconsin that the documentary series The Making of a Murderer was based on, where the 16-year-old co-defendant admitted, confessed to a murder that he did not commit, just because the police had told him, all you have to do is just say you did it, you sign this paper, and then you can go home.
And then you can leave.
Exactly.
And that's really appealing, right? And you don't really realize what that's going to be in the long run.
Right. When you're 16 years old and this adult is telling you all you have to do is sign and you can go home, then you're going to sign because you think you're going to go home.
Which is another way that kids get kind of wrapped up in this too, is an older accomplice, somebody who's older, who they know, they trust, might be an uncle, might be a cousin, might just be somebody around the way. And they might get wrapped up in something because the older person knows the kid is going to be a really good, you know, person to run in and pretend to have that gun and try to get the money from the cashier. Because it's just a kid. They won't get in trouble, right? It should be fine. But in most cases, the kid, actually, we've done studies, the kid ends up getting longer in prison than the adult does in those situations.
Yeah, that happens frequently. Kempis, tell us what you're involved in now. You know, you have become... Whether you want to be or not, you've probably become the face of this thing, and you've got a unique soapbox from which you can sort of preach the gospel here. I know you just got out of prison recently, but what do you intend to do in the coming months and years?
Well, I'm channeling my energy. Right now I'm doing a lot of organizing around Ubuntu Philadelphia. Ubuntu Philadelphia is... something that I've been organizing with Professor Mike Lyons, a professor of journalism and digital media at St. Joseph University. And what this is about creating a space where families of victims and families of people who have committed homicide, as well as those who have committed homicides themselves, whether formerly incarcerated or still incarcerated, calling in by telephone, creating a space where all of these people who fall on different sides of violence can come together and have an open dialogue about healing, about community healing and family healing. You know, this is basically, you know, it's kind of like it was inspired by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of post-apartheid South Africa and the Gacaca courts of post-genocide Rwanda. Because, you know, in both cases, an entire nations needed to heal. Families and communities needed to heal. And this juvenile life without parole issue that we're talking about is presenting that kind of scenario for us over here, where you have hundreds of people coming out of prison en masse back into the communities, people who were convicted for murder a lot of times. You know, and some of them might be innocent. Some of them may have second degree, may have been the young person in the company of some older people, and, you know, and they got life without parole, or what is more aptly known now as death by incarceration, you know, because of their involvement or their association. But for the most part, a lot of the people coming out from prison now, juvenile lifers, have been convicted for murder. And this is not one of those situations where you wake up in the morning and you turn on the news or you open a paper and you see someone who was on death row or in prison for 19 years or 25 years, some DNA information came down and showed that they're innocent and they're exonerated. No, this is not a question of guilt or innocence here. The U.S. Supreme Court said that for the most part, these people are responsible. They are guilty. They have taken lives. However, because of the phase of development that they were in at the time of their lives, that is adolescence, they were less culpable. They had diminished capacity, and so a greater understanding and some more leniency is merited here. Society never had to wrestle with anything like that before. Did not this society. That's unprecedented. And all the talk so far has been about, okay, well, how do we help these individuals, these hundreds of people coming out, to successfully reintegrate into society? That's been the conversation. How do we make the transition smooth? But nowhere in the conversation are we hearing how ready is the community to receive them. You know, it's a lot of pain out there. We're talking about connected to every one of these individuals coming out is a dead person. It's somebody's family member and loved one that used to be here is not here no more. You know what I mean? And this is something that we have to discuss, because if we don't, then the conversation that we're having right now is going to remain an adversarial conversation. It's going to be a conversation. When we're talking about Miller versus Alabama and Montgomery versus Louisiana, that's going to forever be a conversation about winners and losers, who won and who lost, because everybody wasn't able to celebrate when those decisions came down. You know, sure, people like me, and I was able to celebrate. My family, people that support us, the legal teams, were able to celebrate. But what about the families who lost loved ones? You know, for those families, those rulings was like a smack in the face, or justice being taken away, or wounds being opened up, re-traumatization. And in order to have a real conversation, a fair conversation, a forward-moving conversation that evolves our society, that has to be taken into account, because the pain is real, the feelings are legitimate. How do we come together in a space and lift this out of the space of an adversarial conversation, a win-lose conversation, into a conversation that can really evolve our society beyond the way, the woefully, woefully flawed way we've been dealing with these problems? You know, because for real, right now as we're having this conversation, every one of us having this conversation, we know, and everybody that's listening know, that right now some act of violence is taking place. Somewhere. It just took place or is about to take place. We don't know it, but when we turn on the news later, we'll see it. And so how do we get ahead of that and prevent what happened? Things like I did, things like people that were in my situation did. How do we prevent that from happening again, from preventing some other children from committing a horrible act and causing pain, from preventing other families from suffering the loss of their loved ones to senseless violence and the loss of their child to death by incarceration or life without parole? That's the more responsible conversation I think we need to be having. And that's the work that I've been involved in, with organizing Ubuntu Philadelphia, which is an all-day event scheduled for May 12th. And that's where I'm challenging my energy into and having this conversation about restorative justice.
That's really the issue that I think the whole country should be talking about, is restorative justice, because that's the only way we're going to have positive change on this issue. Unfortunately, we're out of time, Kempis. We were joined from Philadelphia by Kempis Songster. He was sentenced to life without parole as a 15-year-old, and he was just released from prison 2 months ago after serving for 30 years. He's now an advocate for ending juvenile life without parole. And we were joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst Nicole Russell. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned, and we'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.